Hey guys, Henry Blomquist here at Club 30. We're back.
We are back.
Jay Lydell, how are we feeling today?
Feeling really good. I think that Club 30 members are going to love this one.
Yeah, we're talking to someone today that I think I've known this guy for, I'm going to guess now, 12 years, something like that. But yeah, incredible career. We might as well just say it. It's John McEnroe.
You know, in the mid-80s, there was a period of time where they were saying, McEnroe, suspend him for a year. These old farts in the tennis federation. Yeah, he's banned for tennis, whatever. And I'd go to, like, a party, you know, and I'd meet, not to drop names, but, I'd be Mick Jagger. Don't change a thing. Jack Nicholson, don't change a thing. Who am I going to listen to? Those two or some old fart that works for the U.S. Tennis Association?
I mean, the guy is true to himself. And that's the most important thing about making it in New York, is understanding who you are and what you're good at and not making that many apologies for when you let people who don't have the same worldview disagree with you. So I thought that was an amazing conversation.
His interest for music, that's where we connected, actually, at a concert back in the day. And we started talking about sports and music, and then one thing led to another, and then we started jamming together and just had a lot of fun to get to know John over the years. So I'm really excited to have him on the show today. And here it is, guys. John McEnroe at Club 30. He's a 7-time Grand Slam winner. He's the only player to be ranked number one singles and doubles at the same time. Welcome to Club 30, tennis legend, Hall of Famer, and rock and roll lover, John McEnroe.
Drum roll, right?
Drum roll.
You're a rocker. I mean, there should be a drum roll.
We got a guitar.
Do that next season. I like the guitar.
But you just came back from Florida.
Yeah.
We actually watched you play pickleball. It was a pickleball slam.
Yes.
And I also heard your comments going into the weekend. You're not a huge fan of pickleball.
No. I would compare it to, I'm trying to think of hockey, but football that comes to mind, like NFL football, it's like playing arena football. You know, it's like one third or one quarter the size. So it's an extremely, in my view, I mean, I'm biased, I'm a tennis guy, but it's a poor man's game. You know, the level that you need in tennis, you know, someone's got to be the best at whatever they do, but it's a lot easier to be a lot closer. You know, it's an equalizer. So the reason I don't think it completely sucks is that I get to play with my friends, and they like it, and they think they can beat me, and they forget that I know a little something about the court, like the geometry of a court, even if it's smaller.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't like what it does to my body. You know, like the day after I played the pickleball slam. Plus, I'm not a spring chicken anymore. I know this is hard to believe, telling all this hair, the color of it. But so I realized before, like a week or so before, I'm like, oh, my God, I haven't really been playing at all. Hopefully they're not playing. Then all of a sudden I hear Agassi and Roddick have been practicing, and Agassi's been with the pickleball pros. And I'm like, oh, great. And then the days leading up to it, Michael and I got thrashed by a couple people. I'm like, who the hell are these people, type of thing. You know, like, you know, go to a local club and get your ass kicked. Wasn't too into that. So that's also like a wake-up call, because I figured, like, at least I've been out there, and I mean, not too much now, admittedly, out there, you know, and with a lot of people. I mean, for a pickleball match, I think there was like 4,000 people, and we're on ESPN. So I'm like basically shitting in my pants. Don't make a fool out of yourself.
I tell you a funny story. I was out at Randall's Island last week. I was talking to your brother, Patrick, and we were talking about this event. And he said, well, John's going to be very honest about how he feels about pickleball. And as we're talking, his phone vibrates and he gets a notification from ESPN where you said pickleball makes me want to throw up. So it was kind of funny as we're talking about it, the statement came up. But I wonder, after this week, and has it changed your mind a little bit?
Well, what I'm hopeful for, actually, is that I did have a couple friends who've come up to me and said to me they actually like tennis more because they understand, like, sort of what it takes in a way. They're on using a racket, and so then they're like, oh, that's made me more interested in tennis. So I was hoping it will be a win-win, because from what I'm hearing, fastest growing sport in America, pickleball. I'm like, give me a break. I don't know, the name is pretty bad to begin with. Who named it? Some guy that owned a pickle company or you know, it's, or, I don't know. And the rules, there's, you know, you can't serve overhand. You know, there's a lot of things that are sort of, to me, equalizers. But, you know, I found, because I was filming a tennis thing yesterday, that originally a serve was meant to be service the ball and just get it into your opponent, you know, nicely, serve underhand.
Yeah.
Well, so maybe pickleball stole something from me. But all that matters is I beat Agassi.
That was a big win. That was a big win. You played well.
It's a big win. Because early on, he was, you know, up on me pretty good. And he's like, all right, John, how you feeling over there? Are you feeling a little tight? Oh, yes. I felt like going, yes, I am feeling tight. But then at the last, you know, when there was like, I forgot, the 15, 13, and I was a point or so from victory. How you feeling now? You know, shoes on the other foot a little bit, okay? You're losing to the old man here.
So you took a sport that was designed to be non-competitive and made it really competitive, which is
all
that matters.
Well, that's what all competitors do.
Yeah.
All athletes do that. I think they find a way to make anything competitive in a way. So I've been actually spending the last 20, 30 years, if not more, trying to tone down the competitiveness a little bit.
But let's get into that a little bit. Like tennis, I've been running into you a couple times on your tennis academy out on Randall's Island.
I love when you come out.
I love playing, and I've seen you out there. And so how often are you on the tennis court today?
As often as I can be out there, because I do love hitting with the kids and, you know, hopefully showing them who's boss, because, you know, they don't know what the hell they're doing. The body doesn't cooperate, you know, as well. I've torn my meniscus a couple times the last 5 years. Fortunately, I've been able to rehab through like a couple shots and rehab, and I've never had a surgery, so my body's been pretty good to me. But, you know, I hit the big 6-0 4 years ago, Henrik. You know, you're looking incredible, but, you know, you're still quite a bit younger than me. So it doesn't get any easier, but like I will go out there. If I'm here a couple weeks, I'll go out, you know, 5 days a week. I love to go out.
Do you coach the kids?
I try to, but they don't seem to listen very much. You know?
I don't.
What do I know? He played with a wood racket.
That's not just a tennis thing.
You know,
brother.
It's like I don't know if it's the same in hockey. If they pay any attention, well, it still seems to be pretty close to the same. But in tennis, it has changed quite a bit.
Yeah.
The surface, the strings, the balls, the this, the that. Players have gotten a lot bigger. I'd like to think the kids listen. You know, hopefully I'm sort of my goal is to be like the inspirational leader. That's what I want to do. I want to sort of get that extra 5-10% out of them. And that could be the difference between getting into a great college, a scholarship, possibly making it in the pro circuit, possibly doing something big, and being an also-ran. That's what parents and the kids don't understand. You know, unfortunately, the kids are easier to teach than the parents. You know, the parents are telling me how to, you know, how it's done now. I'm like, excuse me? Yeah.
And is that extra 5-10, is that, given these, I'm assuming these kids are pretty gifted physically, is it predominantly that mental edge?
I believe so.
Yeah.
You know, but obviously, we're looking for the next, you know, superior athlete. I mean, you want you know, Michael Jordan to walk in and say, I don't want to play basketball, I want to play tennis. That's sort of the idea behind my academy, because I grew up in New York City. I'm biased, I admit. I think it's the greatest city in the world. I've had a lot of great experiences here, lived here my entire life. So I'd like to see the ultimate win-win for me would have this academy and someone come out of, you know, Manhattan or the Bronx or, you know, Queens and win like a U.S. Open. That would be like the ultimate for me. So it's a dream. I did it. I grew up in Queens. I had more advantages. You know, even my father, who was a lawyer and eventually became a partner in a law firm early on, needed scholarship money.
It's expensive.
It's, you know, it's too expensive for most people. So we're trying to raise as much money as possible. So all you millions listening, please donate to the Johnny Mac Tennis Project. No, no, it'd be great. But, you know, we're trying to sort of change the thought process that goes into like making it, because, you know, everyone thinks you gotta leave your house at 10 or 12 and you gotta go to Nick Bollettieri's in Florida and you gotta train 8 hours a day when you're 12. Me personally, I would have quit the game if I'd had to do that. So I'd like to provide an alternative to kids. I actually went to school, high school. I took the subway and the train every day to New York. It was like an hour each way. It was like a eye-opening experience. I think it kept it real for me and in a lot of ways. I made it to the semis of Wimbledon when I was 18 years old before I went to college, but I went to Stanford for a year. I was 21 in the world when I entered college. You know, the highest ranking since then, anyone's been like 600.
Right.
So it was like most people were telling me not to do it, but I think the experience of going to college was helpful to me. Sort of give me time to mature. You saw how cool I was on the court when I met. but I... You know, it helped in a number of ways. One is I like to be part of a team. You know, you spend your whole life being part of a team. I didn't, that outlet for me was really important as a kid, you know, to play basketball. I played a couple of years of high school basketball. I played 4 years of soccer in high school. I think that's unusual. So I would like to show the kids out there it can be done a different way. You know, people convince them, oh, no, you can't.
You
got to
specialize
for Mac was back in the you know, the dark ages. You know, you can't do that now, but I really don't think that's the case. And you see probably not the superstars, not yet Nadal or Federer or Djokovic, but there's been some top 10 players. Evan Anderson went to college, got to 4 or 5 in the world. Isner hit 10. This guy Cam Norrie. There's a lot more kids coming out of college. And I'm not sure about hockey, but in tennis, the lifespan is a lot longer.
Kids growing up today, they have so much knowledge because they can watch it in a different way. I remember when I started playing hockey, I couldn't really watch it. And now you can watch highlights. There's so much feedback constantly. And you can see a lot of the kids, they crave the feedback to get even better.
Sure.
What do you think are the ingredients to become a really good tennis player? Like, what do you need?
Well, you need athleticism and you need a spirit and you need will. Ultimately, because if most of the guys that are out there and girls playing are athletic, you know, some are superior to others. But then it gets down to like heart, you know, and who wants it more. It's hard to teach that. You can sort of push people in the right direction if they listen. I didn't like looking at stats that much and, you know, analytics and all the stuff that you hear about now. I get that some of that is okay, but I think it's swung too far in that other way. Because at my academy, for example, every shot a kid hits, you know, they look like, what did I do? Why don't you figure it out for yourself? You know, that's part of like the beauty of the sport of tennis is that you need to think on your feet. I coached Raonic at the 2016 Wimbledon. I was working with him. I wasn't the only guy. And they look at these, you know, analytics or odds and like Murray, because he had beaten Federer in the semis and played Murray in the final, which was great. It's the best result he ever had. Oh, Murray likes to go cross court on the, you know, backhand return. Murray's, you know, one of the great players to play. If you just started doing that all the time, he would adjust. So I go, like, you got to figure out, like, he's not going to do that. Like, you know, that doesn't mean he can't do the other thing. So that's, to me, where that sort of part of the sport now in all sports is gone too far. Oh, Djokovic, you know, greatest returner ever now. I'd like to see that on grass, even if the grass is firmer.
Yeah.
And it's like, you go to his back. Oh, because I don't know. It's different, I guess, when you're in a goalie. But like, to me, a lot of times you go, oh, his best shot's his forehand? Oh, okay. We're going to go for his forehand. We're going to break it down.
But when you played, obviously people have an opinion and you were pretty loud out there at times. And I could see myself in that, like a lot of emotions. But thinking back.
The Swedes are very emotional.
Very, yeah. They're
all those guys I played with, you know, you could tell exactly what Borg was thinking.
I want to know, when did you play your best? Was it when you were calm and collected or when you were emotional, when did you play your best?
I'm not sure I was ever calm. But you don't want to be where you start, you know, hurting yourself. And I think there's a point where you can push yourself at times and say you feel a little flat, you sort of just get it going, you know, in a way you sort of just get a little louder, I would say. But generally, you always want to feel, believe it or not, to me, I was always under control. You know, I took it to the limit. I got defaulted once in 15 years on the tour because the rules changed and I didn't know the rules had changed.
At the
Australian Open.
Yeah.
I was like, damn it. Sergio, this guy who was my manager, forgot to tell me there was a rule change against Pernfors of another Swede. But I think that I had a pretty good idea of when to, you know, pull it back when necessary.
Yep.
But there were times where I felt like I sort of lost it and hurt me. And other times, where, like when I played Borg, I didn't really need to do anything, because if I did anything, it was magnified like five times, because he never did anything. I mean, you're like, do something. Do something. I remember we played an exhibition once where it was me, Bohr, Connors, and Gerolaitis, my late buddy Vitas Gerolaitis. We were playing in Germany, and I played Connors, and then Vitas played Bohr, and they played a long rally, and at the end of the rally, under his breath, you know, you could hear like a pin drop there. Borg misses a shot and goes, shit, right? Vitas got down on his knees and looked up to the sky, and the crowd gave him a standing ovation because he showed some emotion. So like with him, I didn't need to do it. With Connors, we were so like, you know, two bulls in a china shop just sort of going at each other that it felt like, you know, whoever completely lost at first was the guy that might go down. But, you know, we were always pushing each other to sort of like lose it a little bit. But, you know, in certain ways that was very exciting.
Well, let's talk about the top three, because I wonder about that. I'm a huge Roger Federer fan. I know you really enjoyed watching Roger and commentating on Roger for so many years. He's now out the door. You have Rafa and Djokovic left, but when they're out of the game, will tennis be in a good place?
Well, I remember back in my heyday, the mid-80s, and I was so fed up with like the press I was getting at Wimbledon and the bullshit they were saying in the press and all this other stuff. Now, some of it was my fault, but a lot of it wasn't. And then I was with my ex-wife, who was, you know, an actress and won an Academy Award at 10 years old. And, you know, the two of us together was even more of this, you know, eruption to them. And it really frustrated me to the point where in 1986, when my first son was born, I was like, the hell with these people. I'm going to show Wimbledon who's boss. I'm not playing. And then I, you know, we'll see what happens. The whole sport's going to go to shit. You know, right? And then they're still playing. And I doubled down. Next, I didn't, you know, I played 13 Wimbles. I didn't play 15 because that next year I was like, all right, I'm going to show them again. Now, at that time, I had lost, my ranking had dipped a little bit, but I was still one of the favorites on grass. And I watched as, you know, Pat Cash won once. I mean, he's my buddy. I like him. And Boris Becker won for the second time. But I was like, not too good. You know, they still play. So the point is that these guys are the three, in my opinion, the greatest players that have ever played for different reasons, but they're going to keep playing. This guy Alcaraz is electric.
Is that the next one?
Oh, without a question. This guy's amazing. I mean, if he stays healthy, I mean, he's...
He looks so powerful.
I've never seen a guy, he's probably a half inch bigger than me, maybe 6 feet, half an inch.
Yeah.
That can do everything at that age, at 19. Now, these other guys could do a lot of things. You know, Nadal won, I think he was 19, I think, when he won the French the first of whatever it was, 13 or 14 times, which is insane. And Djokovic was 20, but I think Roger was 22. This guy's more advanced. But of course there's going to be a huge void. You know, Roger is like the classiest guy that you'd ever meet and the most beautiful player I've ever watched. Nadal was the updated version of Connors to me. You know, I've never seen a guy try harder, like every point's the last point you're ever going to play. How do you keep doing that? You know, 16, 18 years that you could care that much. And Djokovic is like a human backboard. This guy's, you know, resilience is his middle name. And mentally, he may be like, you know, it's hard. You can make an argument for all three of them.
Have taken a little bit, like, almost for granted what they've been doing. I try to think of other sports where you had three athletes dominate the way they've been dominating for the past 15 years. And it's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to come up with, or think about another sport where have you seen this?
Certainly not in individual sports.
Well, they psyched these other guys out too. You know, these guys fell like bowling pins. But, you know, what you have to do, what these guys have done a great job doing, is to continue to try to improve. You got to not rest on your laurels. That was a mistake I made. I felt like at a certain point, like when I hit my peak in the mid-80s, this is a cop-out, obviously, but it was like, wow, this is like, I'm winning all these, you know, almost felt like it was too much, you know, in a way. And it was like, I'm not saying share the wealth, but you sort of maybe lose that edge a little bit. So I give them a lot of credit because I sort of sat back and said, okay, you know, I'm a level above everyone. Let's wait and see what they got. Well, unfortunately, they caught up pretty quick and then passed me.
What was it? That was 84.
I would say 84 is my best
incredible year. Incredible. Yeah, 84 and 3.
82 and 3.
Yeah.
And then the next year I was sort of sitting back and, you know, I was with and met my ex-wife and, you know, I still was a match away from being number one again. I blew it at the Open. We had to play Saturday, Sunday those days. I played another damn Swede in the semis that year, Mats Wilander, and I went five sets in the heat. And then Connors had sprained his ankle, so he couldn't really put up any fight against Lendl. So the next day, like, you know, I'm like, feel like I can barely stretch past my knees. And, you know, and everything changed then. It was frustrating. And then when you play catch up and all of a sudden it's like Boris Becker comes along and you're like, I've never seen a guy at 17, 18 years old serve like that. How the hell is this guy doing this? It was incredible. Biggest serve in the history of tennis. He was 18. I played him in Atlanta in an exhibition. We had played once, I think once before that, but he had won Wimbledon. We played a big crowd. I'm like, I've never played anyone that serves bigger. And then 3-4 years later, I was finally sort of like in my head regrouping a little mentally. And I was like, okay, I got to win one more. You know, I'll try to win one more for the Gipper. I'm playing the US Open. I make a run to the semis. Who am I playing? Some 19-year-old. I'm 31 now. Pete Sampras. Okay, I got this. All right. No, didn't turn out that way. Turned out he was pretty good.
Yeah.
So that was an eye-opener. So the moral of the story is, to me, is at least with these guys, why I think they're so amazing, is if you look at, you know, the course of their career, they really did get better. It's arguable that they were their best in their 30s.
What about in hockey, Hank? Like for you, as a young goaltender entering New York, you had probably Waugh, Osick. How did you think the game would be transferred from a goaltender perspective?
Well, thinking back of how much the game changed, you have to be open to change your own game. You can't think that when you arrive, that's one thing. But to stay there, you constantly have to keep pushing yourself and adjust. And, you know, it's almost harder to stay there in
it
a
is.
Way.
Yeah. Because than to get there.
Yeah,
so to get there. Yeah. So, yeah, I think obviously when you do get there, the first year or so, you're so focused on staying.
Sure.
But then you realize, okay, I belong at this level. Now I need to really dig deep here to keep adjusting my game because the game has really changed a lot. We talked about how tennis has changed. Hockey has changed a lot also over the last 15, 20 years. And
they don't hit anymore.
But also when you look at goaltending, the technique, how the movements, if you go every 5-10 years, there's so many new moves that towards the end of my career, there were so many things going on that I didn't grow up doing that. It was hard for me to adjust, but you try to stay in that.
Did you have, John had Pete, like, did you have somebody who came up later in your career that put you on notice, or just from his technique?
Yeah, the guy that's playing now.
Right.
No, supposedly he's good, right?
Pretty good, yeah.
No, I think throughout my career, there was always new guys coming into the league.
But you don't want it on your team necessarily,
yeah,
right?
But yeah, but
are you like, I embrace the competition. I'm like, let me embrace it later on. Yeah. Let me focus on myself.
This
here.
Off here.
I don't need this, whoever this guy is from.
I think because I didn't grow up with a lot of technique. It was a lot of heart and it was a lot of figuring it out. But now guys that were, you know, 5 to 10 years younger than me, it was a different generation of more technique, more structure in the game. So you could see that coming into the league, you know, 5 to 8 years after I entered the league, it was way more structured. And when you have a lot of structure, that's something you can fall back on when you're not playing your best. But there's a combination there where you can't rely on structure.
Yeah,
there's got to be a lot of heart, too, when you play your game.
I did try to help the Rangers many times, but one time in particular, I forgot. I know that it was Super Bowl day, I believe. They played the next day, and the Red Wings came into town. And Chris Chelios is an old buddy of mine. So I said, you got to come up and hang out at my apartment. So he goes, you mind if I bring a couple friends? And I said, sure, you know. So he came with him and Nick Lidstrom, Dominic Hasek, and Robert Lang. And these guys, so I'm thinking, you know, and they had to play. This was Super Bowl Sunday, and they had to play the next day against the Rangers. We had a couple beers.
Yeah.
Okay. As each one went down, I'm like thinking, hey, I'm going to help out the Rangers, right? And so the next day, I'm watching the beginning of the game, and I swear to God, Hasek looked like he was going to fall over. 3 goals in the first, like, 5 minutes. It was 3-0 Rangers. Like, I did my job, yeah. Right? And apparently he said, he brought Chelly over, and he goes, Chelly, I fucked up. But I give up no more goals. And if you the team scores for 4, we win. And they came back and won.
4-3.
So I can say is I tried.
You tried. Yeah. You did your part.
Yeah. I did my part. These guys are tough. You know, they dug deep. You know, and we're talking about legends of hockey. Sure. Some of those guys there, like Chelly and Hasek, he's nuts. They're all nuts. And yeah. Nick Lindstrom's one of the great defensemen that ever played.
Another Swede.
Swedes, right?
Everywhere.
Oh, man.
But, John, like, now you're doing an amazing job on TV, and I'm dipping my toes into that world now. But when you work TV, is there a game plan there, or are you just winging it? You have a feel for it, when to speak, not to speak, because you're so good at it.
Yeah, I don't think there's a game plan, but I do think that you need to be yourself. That's one thing that I think, whether or not you look at the camera, you know, it's like sometimes I hear camera left. Okay, you know, I'm like, I don't care where the camera is anymore. You know, we'll figure the camera should find you in a way.
Yeah.
And you should be, you know, you're part of a team, you know, which is sort of I like. But if you have something to say, people will understand you deserve that opportunity to say it. After all, I did play for a long time and hopefully I had some personality. So I got less worried about sort of the technique of doing things right as we move from each camera, and more about just sort of trying to be, just feel like I don't do like a great deal of studying. Like sometimes I actually like when I see a guy I don't even know, and I sort of think about it the way I would do if I played him, you know, like try to figure him out. Like, let's say we didn't have the opportunity to get all these notes, you know, he's coached by so-and-so from Sweden. I talked to his coach, and he said that he likes to hit his forehand. You know, no one cares.
Do you watch a lot of tennis?
I do watch a lot of tennis.
Yeah,
I mean,
stay updated on what's going on.
I stay updated, yeah. I think that's the main thing that I do. So, you know, we have a tennis channel. Hopefully it will hang around for a while. But that allows any of us that love the sport, and especially someone who's working in the sport, to get a feel for what's happening out there and actually see it. Yeah. You know, I can go watch the tournament that's in Houston this week. It's a little rinky-dink tournament, but you don't miss someone in case someone's coming along. I'd love to see that because I don't want the same old, same old. That's work for me.
Yeah. What tournament is your favorite to work?
My favorite to work are the same two that are my favorite to play. You know, the U.S. Open, I grew up 15 minutes from when they played the tournament. I ball boyed when I was a kid at the U.S. Open when it was at Forest Hills. I have a lot of history there. I've been commentating for 30 years, played, obviously. And then the other is Wimbledon because it's sort of like, well, for golf, like Augusta, you know, so the Masters. It's just like this. And as a kid growing up, I remember I was looking. You see the grass the first couple of days. It's beautiful. You're like, wow, beautiful. And then one of the first times I really watched, Bjorn Borg was playing, and I was watching the match, and, you know, he was pretty young then. This is before he won it, but it was, you know, he was getting there quick. And he won a match, and he goes up, and suddenly you'd see all these people run on the court and, like, run up to him. And then outside the locker room, there was, like, a couple hundred young girls screaming. Like, and I'm like, I want to be a tennis player.
Or I want to be a Swede.
I want to be either one. Yeah. But something there is very appealing, you know, because I couldn't believe it was like the closest thing. I don't know if I ever seen it in tennis before. I haven't actually, like the Beatles almost. I'm not going to say it was like, but for us, that was the equivalent because people were going absolutely crazy. Like he'd just stand there. And I was like, well, maybe I'll grow my hair longer, see if that works.
I remember a few years ago, I brought a friend to Wimbledon, and we were hanging out. We were chatting to Federer during the day. We were watching play, and then at night, I met up with you, had a few beers, and my buddy looked at me that night. He's like, you know what? I can't come back here now. I watched Roger. I talked to Roger. We're having beers with Macro. I can't go back to Wimbledon. But, I mean, it's such a great tournament, and you compare it to the U.S. Open. I feel like U.S. Open is amazing. It's a party. Wimbledon is very, a lot of history and classy, but both of them just a great experience.
Yeah, U.S. Open was the first they had night matches. You know, so people, you know, had a couple, you know, I could get back from work, relax a little, pop up a few, and then all of a sudden the energy would be absolutely insane. So that was very, very cool. Wimbledon's like,
that's right, back proper.
That's why it was so weird the first year I went there. I'm like, what's with these people, man?
Yeah.
They're so polite. This isn't the way it is in New York. Yeah. We're yelling and screaming, get out of my way. You know. All of a sudden, they're like, God, that kid is weird. I go, you're weird, okay?
Yeah.
So there was we had some struggles for a while.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Let's shift gears into music a little bit. The first time I met you, I think, if I'm not mistaken, was at a Bruce Springsteen concert. Mm-hmm. In Jersey, yeah. Actually. We started talking about sports, we talked about music, and we actually said, let's get together and jam a little bit. So we did, and we've had a couple of charity gigs, and it's been awesome. But where is that music interest coming from? Has it always been there?
It was like music, but I didn't really start playing until I went on the road, because you're killing a lot of time. Or you're sitting around your hotel room for God knows how many hours a day. I said, well, this is not a bad idea. Why don't we start, you know, playing? Because I was like playing air guitar or like a guitar with a tennis racket, you know, to Black Sabbath or Led Zeppelin when I was a kid growing up. So then I started playing on the tour and I got my first guitar. It was a Gibson Les Paul. I'm lefty, so there's only out of 100 guitars at a guitar store, there's one lefty. Not a lot of choices. So I picked this one up. Went to Chicago for an event. Soon after, I just started playing. I had a room the size of a house. I mean, this is one of the biggest rooms I ever had. I don't know why I had this thing, but maybe it was because it was a hotel close to the airport. I don't know. But I went and saw Buddy Guy, who's this famous blues musician. And we went to this club, and Buddy Guy put on a show. I mean, the guy was, you know, he was outside playing while the band was playing. I mean,
he's amazing.
So,
yeah.
I was like, why am I bothering, you know, playing guitar? So I went back to my, I smashed the guitar. Just smashed it. I go, freak, what am I wasting my time for? So for a period of time, and you probably know this from playing guitar, it does take some energy and focus. Like it, you know, you sort of feel like, are you going to waste energy for what you're doing?
But different.
It's still a different thing.
Yeah,
but do you when you play guitar, that you know, when you're playing a game before the game?
To me, playing guitar is like, it's relaxing because I still need to pay attention to what I'm doing, but I'm getting a break from hockey and everything else going on in my life. It's kind of like watching a really good movie where you just, it's you, you're playing, and yeah, you need some sort of focus there, but it's still a very, very relaxing feeling. But that makes me think of relaxing feeling. Being on stage sometimes is not that relaxing. I saw you in London. Was it last year with Pearl Jam?
Yeah.
65,000 people. Were you relaxed?
No. Not at all. But, you know, they also have two, three guitar players.
Yeah, okay.
You know, I could lay a total egg and it wouldn't matter. I'm like, am I turned on? You know. But that was awesome. That happened twice in 2 weeks because my wife was in, you know, the band Scandal in the 80s, Patti Smyth, and she's had like, you know, I've top five hits and sold millions of records. She says, the way I play guitar is I wrestle it into submission. I'm not sure that's a compliment.
Well,
but she did a number one song with Don Henley. He's a lead singer in the Eagles. So last year when we went, it was his birthday, or her birthday actually, and the Eagles were playing, and he says, why don't you come play Already Gone? And I'm like, okay.
Wow.
You know? So that was like in the same thing. And then 2 weeks later, Pearl Jam's playing, and I'm sitting there going, it's locked down still. The Pearl Jam's on lockdown. And so I'm like, you got to wear a mask and get tested. And I had the matches. I missed the Stones because I was working. And that's like a legendary place to see music. And Pearl Jam is, I get there finally, it's a little late, and I'm wearing this mask, and all of a sudden I see Eddie. I think he's seasoning, you know. And then it's like, oh, he's just like, you ready to play? You know, like, oh, God. I've got my son-in-law recently. I just played a show a couple of days ago down in, before the pickleball. We played in the Hard Rock. That's tough show when there's people like,
drinking.
Can I get another burger, please? You know, you're like,
that's
maybe
the true
this
test.
Wasn't the best spot.
But music, but you're also very big into art, right?
Yeah.
You love art.
Well, I think I can relate to artists. Like, a lot because they're sort of on their own. You know, they remind me the three jobs that I look at are the most similar: tennis, an artist, and a comedian, you know, a stand-up comedian, because you're out there, you could, you know, you suck. You know, they're like, right. Thank you. Or you go into an art gallery, new show. Oh, that's the worst show I ever saw in my life, yeah. You know. And you know, oh, thanks a lot. I just put 6 months of my life into that. And then some guy screaming at me on the tennis court, you get him out of here, you stupid jerk. You know, and I'm supposed to go, oh, that's okay. Don't worry about it. That's what surprised me, actually, with people. It's like, some guy's going to call me a total asshole, and I'm supposed to go, hey, thank you.
Thank you.
I go, fuck you, too,
yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
Actually, that's sort of what I did. But the bottom line is that those are my two great loves, because I think, I mean, sports is my true love. You use that side of your brain, sort of that competitive side.
Yeah.
Whether it's when we went as kids on the pond to play a little hockey or play basketball, all these other sports. You know, I played them all. But that other side, that sort of more cerebral side, that I didn't do any of that as a kid. I never went to an art museum. My parents never took me to a movie. They'd always take me around to, you know, play tennis. And so I was like, can we take a break once in a while from this tennis thing? But it worked out. So yeah. I got to look at the bright side. But I was a little late to the party, maybe. So that's why I think I appreciate it more. My late buddy, Vitas Karolaitis, was the guy that started taking me down to Soho, which was sort of the epicenter in a way at that time of the art scene. That was the legendary days of CBGBs, you know, go see the Talking Heads, Ramones, all these bands.
What was the first piece you bought?
Piece I bought, I believe, was a photorealistic piece. It was like photorealism. I was like, oh my God, it looks exactly like it would look in a photograph. You live and learn and advance to different things. I mean, I've tried to be open to everything just because there's so many great things you can, whether it's a piece of sculpture, whether it's I didn't get abstract for a long time.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure I totally get it now. He's always, get a female nude, you know. I could always look at a female nude. You know, male nudes, tougher to resell, you know. So there's certain criteria, but a lot keeps changing. Realism had his moment. You had all types of different art all through the decades. I mean, Basquiat was, I never met him. I did go once with Steve Rubell, who owned Studio 54, to, I believe it was Palladium or Xenon, the next place he was opening. And in the place, while we were walking, he was showing me the place as it was about to open. Basquiat, like Kenny Scharf, Keith Haring, and Mente, another artist, were painting away. Like he give you a couple grand to paint the bathroom or something.
Right.
And you didn't realize how, like, wow. I mean, it turns out Basquiat's like, you know, Rafael Nadal or something.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, some of it perhaps is because he died, unfortunately, so young. But I got an opportunity because of tennis to sort of meet a lot of people, get to go to a lot of studios if I wanted to, just see things that I wouldn't maybe normally have the opportunity to see otherwise. And that made me appreciate it that much more. And the music was like the ultimate, though, because, you know, I mean, like Robert Plant or whatever, you know, like Led Zeppelin is my favorite band. You know, I'm sitting there and he's like, oh, God, might, you know, it's love watching you, sort of buttering me. I'm like, what? You know? And then, you know, in the mid-80s, there was a period of time where they were saying, McEnroe, suspend him for a year. You know, these old farts in the tennis federation. Yeah, he's banned for tennis, whatever. And I go to, like, a party, whether it was, like, a quote-unquote Hollywood party or something like that. You know, and I'd meet, not to drop names, but, you know, I'd be Mick Jagger, don't change a thing, right? Jack Nicholson, don't change a thing. Who am I going to listen to? Those two or some old fart that works for the U.S. Tennis Association? You know, come on.
Totally.
But, I mean, you've seen so much in the city. You grew up in the city. You experienced so much on and off the court, meeting people, and you talk about music and art. And it's like, what does New York City mean to you?
It's the reason that I believe I am who I am. You know, I've been lucky because I think I've done a hopefully reasonably good job of navigating the positives and the negatives. I wasn't like an all-night guy necessarily. Of course, I went to Studio 54. There'd be hundreds of people online to get in. And you'd try to get, hey, it's John. I'm, you know, five in the world. Hey, get the hell out of here. You know? So in a way, you know, that made me more of who I, because I was like, man, I got to get to two or three or one or something. I can't even get in. Or I got to have a personality like Vitas. It was like the red carpet just opened the door for him. Like, Vitas, are you going to Studio 54 soon? Yeah. I mean, I was more like a rock guy. You know, I preferred that part of it. But growing up and just sort of, you know, I lived in Queens, but I sort of lived in a suburb. So I wasn't really, the goal was always to get to me, the city's like Manhattan. I know it's spread a bit. Brooklyn's become more hip. You know, it's like Queens and Brooklyn. They didn't exactly mix a whole, you weren't going to Brooklyn a whole lot. So I think that because I went to high school in Manhattan and started to experience it more and more, it's like an addiction. You know, and like the first concert I ever went to was at Madison Square Garden. I went to see Grand Funk Railroad. Not that that's like some major band. I saw Led Zeppelin at Madison Square Garden. You know, I went to Ranger games, not often because, you know, we couldn't afford to go that much, but when a few times, the Knicks, you know, the Knicks won, you know, the NBA title when I was 10. And then a couple of years later, twice in like a 3-year, hey, this is going to happen a lot. The Rangers, you know, I was, when I was 20, I knew like 2/3 of the Rangers the year they lost to the finals to the Canadians. I was in Tokyo, flew back from Tokyo, had this exhibition, went straight from the airport to the Garden for like game 5 that I think they lost in overtime. But I knew all those guys. We went out all the time. And so that was the time where they were encouraging, you know, sort of the Rangers to live in the city. Hey, that's a good idea. Well, some of them took it a little too far.
That's weird.
And, you know, I'd be around, you know, okay, you know, and I don't want to be part of hurting the Rangers. I want to hurt the opponent like I tried with the Red Wings. But those were, like, great times, it felt like, in the city. Because the city was a little, in the 70s, was a little rough. You know, it was going through some tough times. But it sort of just felt like the timing just was so beautiful. And it was just so... I was proud to sort of feel like I was representing in a way. I've got to say,
to me, you feel very New York with all your interests and what you're up to. And in the fall, last fall, I saw you out in California, a beautiful house on the ocean. Mm-hmm. And will you ever be there full time, or New York will always be part of your?
Oh, it's got to be always part of it.
Yeah,
yeah. I don't know if I could live anywhere full time. You know, it's great to have a mix a little bit. Little yin and yang.
Yeah.
But if I had to, I could easily live in New York. I mean, it's, you know, there's a lifestyle that's easier. As you get older, you don't need quite as much, you know, chaos, perhaps. You know, it's nice to, you know, I had 6 kids. I've tried to, you know, you want to maintain hopefully a good relationship. I had my first grandkid like a month ago or
Congrats.
So. Yeah, thank you. I think. Yeah. It was like, I'm getting old, man. But no. And also because of the pandemic, I mean, it was weird here. You know what?
It was.
It was in all the cities, but particularly New York. Because to me, if like New York's not cooking, our country's not going to be cooking. I mean, maybe I'm biased, but you can't have like New York going down the tubes or whatever.
Yeah, I was going to the Garden the other day. We're going for dinner first. It was a beautiful day out. And Soho was on fire.
Yeah.
There was people everywhere. It makes me so happy every time I see the city energized, people happy, being out and just having a great time, and then go to the Garden. That night it was Bruce Springsteen playing, but it was just...
What about you, though? Would you ever consider like going back to Sweden, more like easy life as opposed to New York?
I think I like it here. My wife, Therese, loves it here. Kids love it here. So I feel like this is home now. We go back to Sweden every summer.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important time to... Kind of get the contrast in life too. It's slower, it's more relaxed, and then you come back here as a kid at Christmas in late August. I just love coming back, being away for a few weeks or a month, and then you come back to the city. It's always a great feeling. Really appreciate you coming on the show, talking about
Taksimukia.
Taksimukia.
That I know that and a couple bad words, but I
in
won't
Swedish,
say
it. Yeah.
It's Swedish.
Yeah, thanks to
no,
Bjorn.
No, we really appreciate it, man.
Yeah, thanks, John.
You're busy, man.
It was fun.
But it's
no,
great
no.
to see
yeah,
you always.
Awesome.
And let's plan another jam session for sure.
And let's get on the court, too, because you're playing again, right?
I'm back. I'm beautiful. Back.
The best players that I ever had right now, I'm going to say, I think, was Henrik on the tennis court.
Yeah.
Other athletes. Henrik, Steve Nash plays pretty good.
Is he good? Yeah.
You guys should go at
I
it.
I heard rumors about that up at Randall's. He's a very good player.
Yeah, he is. He's up at Randall's. He's come out a bunch of times. So yeah. I'd love to see you two guys go at it. Two competitors, right?
Yeah. You got to make that happen.
And we'll play double. I'll get my brother. We'll play me and you against Nash McEnroe.
Love it.
Love it.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with John. A lot of fun stories. I could have stopped laughing a few times there, but, you know, it's just great to hear some of the old stories and his perspective on tennis today and where it was and where it's going.
To be honest, I thought he was going to put us both out of a job because we didn't really have to do much in this one. he's a powerhouse, you know, and I hope the audience and our Club 30 members felt the same way. That was tons of energy. If you did like the show, we would love to have you guys out there as club members. So please subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
See you guys.